All right, so I'm here to talk to y'all about manual therapy techniques. So being a fellow in manual therapy and going through all the additional training, I have lots of experience in manual therapy. So hopefully I'm here to ease y'all's kind of fear on providing manual therapy. So to start, I have no conflicts of interest or disclosures to speak of. The objectives today are to introduce manual therapy, describe some of the benefits of manual therapy, and then hopefully go through some case examples of when I would typically use manual therapy in the training room or the clinic setting. So Kevin had mentioned earlier about what your rehab toolbox looks like. Well, I'm here to encourage y'all to add manual therapy to y'all's rehab toolbox, because you don't need a lot of equipment for manual therapy. All you need is your hands. So manual therapy is just any intervention that requires skilled hands-on techniques. So those that are in smaller training rooms or smaller clinics, you don't need all this fancy equipment. You can lay your hands on the patient or athlete and provide positive outcomes. Okay, now, typically when people think of manual therapy, what they're thinking of are joint mobilizations or manipulations. There are different grades of joint mobilizations or manipulations. They go all the way from grade one, which is typically used for more pain relief. Mainly you're just gently putting your hands on the patient just to calm them down, all the way up to grade five, where we get that thrust manipulation, that high velocity, low amplitude. We're going past their physiological end range to create a cavitation. Now there's a lot of research or a lot of dispute on whether we should do thrust manipulation or non-thrust manipulation and which one has the largest benefit. As with any research, there's both sides of the fence, and whatever you want to find, you can find in the research. So there's research that says, oh, you need to do thrust manipulation because that's going to get the biggest bang for the buck and you're going to get a nice positive outcome from that. On the flip side, the next article will say, well, there's not really much difference between a thrust manipulation and a non-thrust manipulation or mobilization. And then you see, well, no, we need to do thrust manipulation again, especially when it comes to the spine. But what they've seen is that it really doesn't matter what technique you do, there's usually some type of positive outcome. Now, my philosophy in it is I'm going to do the least amount of work possible on myself. So I'm going to try to do a thrust manipulation because that takes about 10 seconds to perform, whereas a mobilization can take 2 to 5 minutes, depending on the joint or technique that you're using to mobilize. And when we're in busy clinics or busy training rooms, we don't have time to spend with our athlete or patient for that amount of time when there's three other people waiting on us. So my philosophy is, as long as it's safe for the patient or athlete, I'm going to try that thrust manipulation first and then move it and move on, essentially. So what's all the fuss about manual therapy? Well, there's tons of articles in the literature that all come to a pretty nice consensus on manual therapy when paired with exercise or any other treatment modality is going to result in a better overall outcome, especially when you look at the short-term and long-term effects, all right? So there's overwhelming amount of research that says that we should at least be doing some kind of manual therapy to make our patients better faster. When we look at the benefits of manual therapy, we don't really know why it's beneficial. We have a lot of theories, as you can see on the diagram above. It ranges all the way from changing something mechanically in this bottom left-hand corner to just providing a placebo effect. You've heard the placebo effect a lot in the previous lectures. Well, this applies to manual therapy even more so, right? And that's in the top right-hand corner. There's also a super physiological effect, so we're messing with the brain a little bit. And then there's some peripheral and central sensitization that occurs. When I'm discussing it with patients or athletes, these are the benefits that I will typically explain to them. We first get a mechanical effect, so we're addressing the joint capsule, the ligaments, the muscles that surround the joints. It used to be said that, you know, we're realigning the spine or we're putting the hip back into place. Unfortunately, recent research is not really in support of that. They do show some transient changes, some very short-term changes in alignment, but they're not seeing that this lasts for any significant period of time to create those effects that we used to think of. But we are still providing a quick stretch to the joint capsule ligaments, muscles, even the neural structures around there. So we know that that has some positive change as well. Then there's the neurophysiological effect. So we get some CNS changes both centrally and peripherally. That's going to help with facilitation and inhibition of muscles that surround the area that you're manipulating. We get the biomechanical or biochemical response. So we have some release of endogenous opioids. You do a thrust manipulation, and then all of a sudden they say, oh, that felt so good. Can we do that again? Well, that's because they're getting this opioid release. And then, of course, the placebo effect or the psychological effect. We're putting our hands on a patient, right? Studies have shown just if you place a warm hand on a patient, they usually start to feel better, right? So we're also placing our hands on them to give them the expectation that we're doing something to them, right? And when you're doing something to them, they expect some kind of result. And what that result is typically they're going to have a positive expectation of the outcome. So they're going to have a positive response to it. Now, when looking at some barriers to utilization, typically it's going to be because of confidence or skill of the clinician or trainer, right? Or some perceived difficulties in performing the techniques, or that they might be unsafe. I'm here to tell y'all that most of the techniques that you'll be performing are very safe. There's very little adverse events that are documented in the literature, as long as you're using some clinical reasoning to go along with it. Are we going to manipulate or mobilize someone that recently had a fracture? Probably not. If they have any gross instability, we're not going to be addressing those people with manual therapy, at least not with the thrust manipulation techniques, right? We might do some gentle moves or something like that. Also, I've already kind of alluded to the limited time component, right? That's why I will typically use a thrust manipulation versus a mobilization, because I have limited time to spend with my patients or athletes. So I'm going to get in and get out as quick as I can, and then I'm going to educate them on how to promote that movement that I just got them. So to go through some case examples now, I've got an upper extremity case and a lower extremity case just to kind of highlight how I would utilize manual therapy in these cases to get them better, hopefully faster, right? The first one is one that most of y'all will surely have seen before, neurogenic thoracic outlet, if you want to call it that. We have a 17-year-old baseball pitcher presenting with complaints of numbness and tingling into the right arm and pain at the medial border of the scapula. We see this all the time, right? Now, of course, you want to rule out any sinister diagnoses in the beginning, right? Make sure there's no fracture, make sure there's no discogenic symptoms, no myotomal changes or anything like that. They could really be cramping down on the nerve, and then they need to get sent out for further imaging, right? Since this case is not involved with a trauma, we can be pretty safe to say that there's probably no fracture that's happening there, but you still want to rule it out just to make sure. You're then going to kind of look at their global movement and see, oh, they've got some limited thoracic mobility, CT junctions, a little kyphotic, right? They got the text neck going on. They're a high schooler. They spend a lot of time on the phone. And then they have some positive neural tension. Usually in these cases, it's going to be the median and ulnar nerve. So I look at this case and I see, all right, I want to start proximally and then work distally, right? So I'm going to start with a thoracic manipulation or addressing the thoracic spine. I'm doing this to improve thoracic range of motion, specifically in pitchers. It's usually extension and rotation. I'm then going to try to reduce stress through the CT joint, right? And then I'm also going to provide a neurogenic reset to those muscles. There's been plenty of research that says that the mid and low trap have improved activation after performing a thoracic gapping manipulation. And then also hopefully going to be reducing some muscles that are overactive at that time. Usually for pitchers, it's upper trap, levator. We see this all the time, not just with pitchers, with any upper extremity athlete. Starting proximal, I'm now going to work a little bit distal and then work out, right? So I'm then going to perform a CT junction manipulation. hopefully to improve CT range of motion, right? Specifically extension. Improve cervical range of motion, because this is also a cervical manip. Oftentimes we get cavitations in the cervical spine with this. And then hopefully reduce overall facilitation. Typically, if they're having some neurogenic symptoms, you got to think upper trap, levator, and then also scalenes is going to be a big player in these patients or athletes. So this is typically going to be a go-to manip for anybody that presents like this, and specifically if they present with pain at their upper trap or base of their neck, and they point to their CT junction when they rotate to the right or side bend to the right. That's going to be your go-to manip to try to free up that CT junction and relieve a lot of their symptoms. So these are just some pictures. We'll kind of go through them in lab a little bit just to practice and maybe let some of y'all practice on me. The thoracic gapping manip is probably the manip that I use the most hands down in the clinic because it helps with lumbar patients, it helps with neck patients, shoulder patients, people that have neural tension in their upper or lower extremities. This is a manip that can kind of free up a lot of different things, right? So we talk about regional interdependence. Everything starts proximal, so this is gonna be one of the manips that I use the most. And it's probably one of the safest manips to do. So if you are uncomfortable with all the other manips, get comfortable with this one because this one has probably the biggest bang for the buck. Then I'll perform a CT junction manip, like I said. This one is a little bit unique because it is more of a mid-range manipulation, which means I'm not taking them to their physiological end range before I start my thrust manipulation. So I'll kind of go over this in lab as well. The easy thing about it is that if you're treating the right side, everything is going to be on the right side. So you're standing on the right side, their arm is up on the right side, they're rotated and looking to their right side. So it's really easy to remember how to set this up. The trick is getting the speed and everything down. It takes a lot of reps to do this, but it's a very safe manip because it starts in mid-range. So oftentimes people are very kind of cautious because they're messing with the neck. Well, the neck is not going to be compromised in this position because we're at that mid-range, okay? And then of course, we need to follow it up. As I mentioned earlier, manual therapy is best when in conjunction with exercise, okay? So to follow it up, we want to provide some focused exercise, meaningful exercises to give them, right? So these, some of y'all probably already do these often, thoracic extension with the foam roll, thoracic extension in the chair, some of those cat camels, love those yoga poses, thoracic rotation, especially for pitchers. And if we're wanting to address the scalenes, we can also do a first rib mobilization or scalene stretch, right? Which is seen in the center there. Now we move on to the lower extremity case. This is an ankle sprain, right? 16-year-old soccer player suffers an inversion ankle sprain during practice. You initially manage them like we all would, you know, brace them up, send them home, try to get some of that swelling down with whatever modalities y'all want to use. And then they come in the next day and they're saying that they still have pain with weight bearing. They feel like, especially in this case specifically, they feel like they're stepping on an acorn, right? They don't have any signs of fracture, so you're not worried about that, but they're still having some of that persistent pain. And it's not in the typical area of an ankle sprain. It's not right over that ATFL. It's more on the foot, specifically on the bottom of the foot. So in these cases, you wanna start looking at their cuboid, right? So oftentimes your cuboid will be a little bit tender with lateral ankle sprains or with anyone with chronic ankle instability. Oftentimes that cuboid gets plantar flexed down and starts causing some pain because they're literally just stepping on their cuboid with every step, right? So ways that I would manage this, I would first do a talocrural joint distraction manip to increase dorsiflexion. We know that dorsiflexion or limited dorsiflexion range of motion is actually, it actually correlates really well with predictors of injury or current injury in athletes. And if y'all test most of your athletes or patients, you're gonna see most likely that they have some dorsiflexion limitations. So a talocrural manip is a really easy and effective way to gain some of that dorsiflexion back. We also want to reset the talocrural joint alignment. After a lateral ankle sprain, oftentimes that talus is shifted just a little bit anterior. So a distraction manip can reset that joint alignment and take stress off of the ATFL. And then of course we get the neurogenic response. We want to improve proprioception, those peroneals, posterior tib, intrinsic foot muscles. We want to get those firing a little bit better. For the cuboid manip, we want to obviously reset the cuboid. If it's plantar flexed down, we want to try to realign it, per se, by resetting it and reducing pain. That's probably the main thing that I've seen, is that after performing this manip on patients where this is utilized, is they have an immediate, probably 90-95% reduction in their pain with walking after you perform this manip, right? Now, it's in very specific cases. I think the literature says about 7% of lateral ankle sprains will have a cuboid dysfunction with it. So here are the pictures of that. Again, we'll kind of go over these in the lab session. The talocrural manip, this is probably the manip that if you're learning to do manips and practicing your speed, it's probably the one that you're gonna learn first because it's so easy to do and yet so effective. The cuboid manip is a little bit more advanced technique. But very easy to do. You can even just squeeze the cuboid and oftentimes it'll pop back into place or cavitate back into place. And then of course, follow it up. Lots of proprioception exercises, closed chain, doing some balance stuff, get them better. You can even do the four-way ankle exercises to kick on some of those muscles. Providing them with dorsiflexion range of motion exercises can be a little bit more tricky. But there's a lot of YouTube videos on self-mobilizations for the talocrural joint. If y'all have ever heard of Kelly Starrett, he's the Supple Leopard, he has a book, provides a lot of good examples with those resistive power bands on how you can self-mobilize. He does it for the ankle, he does it for pretty much any joint. But he's got a lot of YouTube videos, so he's worth checking out. All right, so in the breakout, we're gonna talk about evaluation of need. We're gonna demonstrate the manips, and then we're gonna discuss alternative manips that y'all might need to do if the patient's a lot larger than you, if you're having difficulty with one manip over the other. So we'll kind of talk about ways that you can troubleshoot through this. There's my references. If you have any questions or comments or want a copy of this presentation, feel free to shoot me an email, okay? Any questions? I wanted to leave enough time for Brian, because if y'all know Brian.
Anybody have any questions? No? Doing the hands-on joint manipulations, do you think that there's any worry or concern with specific younger populations in today's age with physical contact, that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the youngest I'll probably feel comfortable manipulating is around 12, 13 years old. If you look at a lot of chiropractors will manipulate babies. So when you're concerned about whether they're too young to manipulate, know that there are chiropractors that are manipulating newborn infants that are less than 2 weeks old. So in general, it's a very safe technique. If there's anything that I'm concerned about, I'm gonna kind of read the patient and see, you know, what they're feeling as I'm putting my hands on it, as I'm assessing the joint, and that will let me determine whether I'm actually gonna perform the manipulation or not.
Does anybody have any questions? Anybody else? Thank you, Dexter.
Mm-hmm.